Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
Hello and welcome to The Word Podcast. I'm David Hepworth and I'm joined by...
Andrew Harrison.
And...
Mark Ellen.
Is everybody well?
Why?
That's a very loaded question, Dave. Yeah, we're fine, thanks.
Good. We've got some... Are you well, Mark?
I have a raging hangover. I'll be absolutely honest with you, David. I have got a hangover. I did have a party yesterday. It was my 25th wedding anniversary. And the party went on for 11 hours. So there we are.
It's more than you can take.
Yeah, it was terrific. And ended with my two sons, this is probably what cleared people off eventually, doing their terrific set of Daniel Johnson covers on the acoustic guitar. Isn't that great?
For the benefit of anybody who doesn't know, can we have a thumbnail sketch of Daniel Johnson? Because he's not the most obvious.
He's a legendary depressive, I think, yes. First of all. Poor old boy.
Says, we now like to play a couple of songs.
Yeah, by a guy in his late 40s who's living with his parents. That's right, you know. And on strong medication. But he's a wonderful fellow. Yeah. He's written some brilliant songs.
So you basically said, when it comes to half past 11, we want to clear the room. Get up, do Daniel Johnson.
Do Daniel Johnson, and we'll go to bed.
We were only talking about this last time, weren't we? Music to clear a room. So, you know, Rob and Tom Ellen are available.
Come round. End your party.
Clear your party. And we're also in the pod, having a drink of water at the moment, is Matt. Let's say hello, Matt.
Hello.
Matt, amongst the feedback on the Word Magazine podcast Facebook group, I wish that Matt Hall was featured more often. He's a great voice and lots of interesting things to say.
Matt's mum.
That's
Mum, don't embarrass me.
It's Brian Cleary who said that. Is that your gay lover?
I swear it's not.
Are you going to be the Smiley Marley of the Word podcast?
Excellent. Yes.
Anyway, Matt was. We were trying to fill up a notional map of the world with little flashing lights for where there are people listening to the podcast. You know, mm-hmm. So we're asking people to get in touch and tell us. And we got James Lloyd Choles, to give him his formal title, who got in touch from China, saying how much he enjoyed the Richard Hawley gags and was amazed that they'd made it past the Chinese censor.
Really?
Now this makes you think.
Yeah.
Do they have somebody in a room who listens to podcasts?
Well, they've got 2 billion people, Dave, you see. They've got to find something for them all to do. So some poor Chinese fellow sitting there going... What's that thing about Van Morrison and the mouth organ? They're all sitting there, you know, parsing the Word podcast. So if you're there, hello, China.
Yes, hello. We'd love to get in touch with the gentleman or lady.
Hello, China. Our version of the Van Morrison story just had long gaps in it. Please tell us what happened. So on that note, Dave, I think we should have, because I got several emails about those Richard Hawley jokes, and God bless Richard Hawley, because it's quite nice of him to let us nick all his material.
Well, he
I think we should have a one-liner. As you do, exactly. I think we should have a one-liner of the week.
Oh, no, go on,
and I think I've got one for you. I saw my brother-in-law yesterday at this party. We're talking about Groucho Marx. He came up with one of Groucho Marx's brilliant lines, which I thought was very funny. I don't remember which film it is. He's talking to Margaret Dumont. Was it Margaret Dumont?
Yeah.
And she says, well, I'm off to get my beauty sleep. And he says, set the alarm for December.
Very good. So also, travelling around the world, we heard from Michael, I think I'm saying this right, Gerstenberger in Germany, who took issue, Mark, with your saying that Ginger Baker sang Mother's Lament at the Albert Hall. Because according to Michael, who presumably came all the way from Germany, he did Pressed Rat and Warthog.
Oh, sorry, it was Pressed Rat and Warthog. You're absolutely
now,
right.
Can you give us a little...
But isn't that the one? The mother was washing her baby?
No, it's not.
It's Pressed Rat and Warthog. Something opened
they closed
their shop.
Down
they
the
closed
shop.
Down their shop.
Da-da-da-da-da. It was all
that
they got.
Sold, yeah. Oh, God, I can remember it sold all sorts of weird things. That's exactly right. And the reason, it's good. And the reason he did it, I think, was in order, very cunningly at the end, to plug the fact that, of course, Cream had a lot of very attractive and expensive merchandise available. He said, because he said press rep will have closed down the shop, but Kareem haven't. And if you want to buy a T-shirt, then there's one in the foyer. I thought, clunk, crowbarred that one in.
So we also heard from Patrice in Thailand. So anybody else in, you know, far-flung parts of the world, we'd like to hear from them, wouldn't we, Matt?
And get in touch on who was the gentleman from Wellington who asked if it was the furthest from where the podcast was actually recorded?
Oh, that's Wellington, New Zealand. I actually haven't got a note here myself, but yeah, hello to everybody in Wellington, New Zealand. You probably are about as far away. You know, unless there's somebody on the Pitcairn Islands, that's probably about as far away as we can get, isn't it?
Can I mention Brian McCluskey as well, who sent this fantastic email in? He says he was listening to the one we did about 3 or 4 weeks ago about Sly Stone's gig. Do you remember we talked about, it was in the piece in Word, actually, there was a Scottish guy heckling so vigorously that he was ejected from the concert.
Jim Irvin was talking about it, right.
A complaint, this guy was so miserable about the low quality of Sly's performance that, and he used some quite colourful language. He called him a Berkshire Hunt, Dave. Very loud. Anyway, he was put in a half Nelson and bundled out of this concert, do you remember? And then eventually the bouncers let him back in again because they thought it was a fair point and well made. anyway, this guy has got in touch. He said, I was listening to your podcast and I realised I am the person ranting and raving at the back of the venue that Sly Stone and the Family, Sly and the Family Stone were playing in Bournemouth. Certainly the phrase, never seen a musician piss away a legacy, has the ring of being one of mine. Your guest's impression on me was worryingly accurate. I think Jim may well have done a hilarious Scottish accent, but anyway, Brian did
so
not mind.
He's
immortalised.
He's heading for heckler immortality, isn't he?
He is, yeah.
That might make a good list. Well, who else?
Judas is probably number one, isn't he?
Judas, absolutely, on the Bob Dylan thing.
And just somebody, who was the bloke you heard shouting, do some old.
Oh, do some old, and so my old friend Robin Hitchcock was playing a concert. Now, apparently this is what American audiences shout all the time now, when they paid their money, they paid their $50. They don't want to hear the new album. And to be honest, I can often share that sentiment. They just go, do some old! Except in an American
accent.
Sorry,
yeah.
I came out and started what that was.
So also in the Heckler Hall of Fame is, and this is just for Mark and myself, really, of a certain vintage, on the Allman Brothers Live at the Fillmore East, somebody famously shouts, somebody famously shouts, Whipping Post!
That's right.
And then they play Whipping Post. And for years, people used to go to gigs of all kinds of bands all over the world. Whenever there was a pause, people would just go, Whipping Post!
And why?
I don't quite know.
Poor bands were often rather mystified.
Hasn't More Cowbell taken
You had to be there, Andrew. It was hilarious.
More Cowbell. Tell the story of More Cowbell.
God, I hardly know the More Cowbell story. You know it.
Well, I think I do. Well, I've seen this. This is a famous, now a kind of legendary YouTube clip, isn't it? It comes from Saturday Night Live.
I think so, yeah.
And it's basically got a load of the actors pretending to be those low-rise, clever heavy metalers, Blue Oyster Cult, as they're recording
Will Ferrell's in it, isn't it?
Don't Fear the Reaper. Oh, well, yeah, possibly under a particular disguise. And Christopher Walken plays the very threatening, because he doesn't know how to do anything other than very threatening producer.
Yes.
And they're doing Don't Fear the Reaper. And if you go away and listen to Don't Fear the Reaper, and do go and look up this clip on YouTube, because it is very funny, one of the most prominent features of the soundscape is the cowbell. You know, as soon as the rhythm track comes in, you get a donk, 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 a cowbell. And Christopher Walken's only production instruction throughout this whole sketch is he just keeps coming back out and going, more cowbell. More cowbell. And there they are, miming away and banging the cowbell. And anyway, that became a well-known YouTube clip.
Do you remember the people of a certain age? Do you remember shouting Wally at festivals? You didn't go to festivals, Dave. You had more sense. Right? I used to go to every rock festival. Well, and for some reason, bloke called Wally got lost. Andrew's given me a look of consternation here. Oh, the old people are talking about their glory days of rock and throwing more logs upon the fire. And uncooking their cherry brandies, and you know, we'll get on to New Order in a minute.
We're coming back up today.
New Order are very, very nearly ready for their bus passes, man.
Spring chickens,
their retirement.
No, but there was some guy got lost at a rock festival. I don't know, I thought he was at Reading Festival in 1971 called Wally, and so he's shouting Wally, and they're all shouting Wally. And so that used to happen at festivals. Oh, God, it probably still does now.
You know what?
And everyone sat it down doesn't. And all shouted Wally.
And since the book came out, since the words Wally book came out, it does not happen.
Am I correct in thinking that somebody told me recently they'd been to a gig and they'd seen Jesus had reappeared? Jesus to London gig-goers of a certain age was a chap with a very distinctive kind of pudding bowl haircut who used to appear wearing a caftan.
Oh, yeah.
And vigorously banging a tambourine at just about every gig.
Every gig. There was excited correspondence on the Rocking Vicars website about him. He was sighted, wasn't he, in a pub in North London.
But he'd come back out of retirement.
Yes, he's all been resurrected.
20 years away.
Was it the real Jesus?
Roll away the stone. And now he's become this extraordinary old guy, probably in his 70s now, still shaking his maracas.
Well, it was definitely the real Jesus then, not one of the hundreds and hundreds of completely identical bowl-head haircut caftan mob that you
in the great man's defence, he had a sort of proto-mullet, didn't he, where nobody ever had it. Yes. An awful sort of rat's tail.
He was trembling towards a mullet.
It was a mullet. And also carried a tambourine, which was always a giveaway.
Used to see him on the tube with his tambourine.
Last time I saw him was the Stranglers at Battersea Park. Yes. I remember being absolutely astonished. With his they were
Jesus,
and I thought this guy isn't really concentrating because I thought his heart and soul was in things like Hatfield of the North. I was just seeing watching.
No,
the
he didn't care.
But he really was completely indiscriminate. You know, there were the naked women prancing around the station. I don't think he's was aware of it really. Yeah. He could just hear rhythms in inanimate objects and was tapping his tambourine.
Surely he was the Son of God.
He was the Son of God.
The Word.
So anyway, more feedback. I ought to mention we ask people also where and when and where that they listen to the podcast. We're interested in that. And David Graham tells us he listens to it on his way home from work because he needs it to restore a smile to his face because he's an oncologist, he's a cancer specialist. So,
okay.
So that's very fine.
Glad to be of service.
We're absolutely delighted to be of service to you, David. And also a technical point here. Somebody in defence of the highness of thigh here, somebody says, the echo on the Word podcast adds a charming amateurishness which genuinely adds to its enjoyability. And we say, what does he know? And he says, I'm the head of BBC News.
I think that's one of them. So if he wants any, if they want to sort of rethink the appeal of the Today programme, well, I suggest what they do is get old Jim Naughty and
do it in a bucket.
In a little lockup like us with a palm frond and some old mail sack and put a little tiny microphone, which I'm picking up now, on top of a raincoat.
You just deafened the readers.
I've just deafened the readers by picking up the mic. I'm sorry about that.
So you're suggesting they do the Today programme from inside the oubliette from which we'd perform this podcast?
I would have thought so, We could borrow their studio for a week. Let's just swap places and see if there's a job exchange, isn't it? Yeah.
So, as they say on the radio, keep that feedback coming. We do appreciate it. We love to hear from you.
This is like two-way family favourites, isn't it?
Absolutely.
We've done the world now. We're going to need BFPO.
If there's anybody in Munster, this is the Teddy Bears Picnic.
Fantastic. I'm going to send you the Beano annual.
That's right.
The Dam Buster's coming up later. Don't worry. And keep joining the Word, the podcast Facebook group, all that, which went over 300 this weekend. We're very excited about that. So anyway,
Facebook with a bullet. I'm really confused.
Mark's joined Facebook by mistake. You know this.
I've been trying not to join Facebook, but I've somehow been joined because people are asking me to join.
No, you did it yourself.
Did I?
Yeah.
Well, what button did I press? Can I Apple Z?
You're trying to order a cup of tea and you accidentally joined Facebook.
My brother-in-law's obsessed. I'm talking about my brother-in-law. He's obsessed with Apple Z. I don't know if anyone who spends a lot of time on computers, I'm sure everybody listening does, he says, the thing is, you go out to dinner or something, you knock over a glass of red wine all over somebody's dress, right? He said, he finds himself reaching for this Apple Z.
I do that.
You know, because you just feel, can you undo the things you do in life as easily as you can on a computer?
Wouldn't that
be wonderful?
But my mate Steve Hicks, who was the designer on the late Great
Oh,
magazine,
Hicks, I remember very well, yeah.
He spent so much time operating desktop publishing that when he was on the tube on the way home and he'd see somebody sort of leaning in an asymmetric fashion in the tube seat with legs to the left and legs to the right. In his mind, he would be doing Command-C, centre their legs.
That's right, centre their legs. Like, that's right. Which one of them can do that?
Command-C, Command-Z.
It's trying to adjust the world so that it behaves like a digital device.
Well, you get used to be able to controlling it through computers, and when you knock off, it's just a shame that you can't anymore, isn't it?
These listeners are going, what happened to the music-related Word podcast?
Yeah, well, talking about the computers.
I'll tell you what. No, I think it's something that's come up today that we're just talking about. Is Virgin Megastores are being sold, Andrew.
R.I.P. That you, it would be very hard to find a version on the high street anymore. Yes, they're sold. Yeah, it's been sold to a load of
it's managed by buyout, as far as we understand. Is it confirmed?
I can confirm, Dave. Management buyout, I think it is, anyway. And it's no longer going to be called Virgin Megastores.
What's it going to be called, then?
It's going to be called...
Not the spinning disc? No?
It's not going to be called Tunes R.O.'s or anything like that.
It's not going to be called Seen and Heard?
No, it's not going to be called Vinyl Solution or any of that kind of carry on.
Oh, come on, keep this going for a while.
It's going to be, well, actually, viewers, if you want to suggest a better name for Virgin, email them in, because whatever you come up with is going to be better than Zavvi.
How do you spell that, Zavvi?
Z-A-V-V-I, I think.
Yep. Is that some kind of acronym or something?
I think it's something that's been generated by a branding consultancy on the basis that there's no way somebody will already own Zavvi.com, so we can buy it ourselves. So it'll search up easily on Google, because if you call it Tune Bucket or whatever, then there'll be a Tune Bucket or something out there.
Yeah.
So made up words are really powerful on the internet. Come on, back to the bloody internet.
In West London, there's a pizza chain called ZZ, so a lot of people are going in there asking for a margarita with it.
Yeah, well,
there's a posh fish restaurant called Zilly's, isn't it?
And Zamo from Grange Hill, as Eamon Ford from the Word has pointed out, he'll be in great demand now.
Zamo from Grange Hill, last I heard, worked in a hardware store very, very near the Virgin Megastore in Soho.
Yeah.
Just across the road from where we used to work on Oxford Street. He used to work in that hardware store around there. People used to go in and buy a few screws just to have a look.
You used to be able to buy dance records from Roland. We only want to help you, Roland. He sold dance tunes up by the archway. And I think the story had a bit of a funny old ending, that one, didn't it? Anyway,
So
anyway...
Is this a new theme, you think?
What?
Being served by ex-rock stars. There's an antique shop in Chiswick where there's a member of Rare Bird.
Oh, really?
They'll sell you a brass candlestick. I think there's a theme here.
So how did you
being served?
Well, I discovered because he just looks like a member of Rare Bird, if I make
sense.
No, Dave. He looks like an unreconstructed hippie.
Well, tell me what it's like going in.
Well, what you do is you go in there and you basically get to go. You think he looks like kind of rock centric geezer. He may even have been wearing a Grateful Dead t-shirt or something, which is not the normal couture for people trying to sell brass candlesticks. And I think I got a conversation with him about things rock and roll. And they can't resist, nor can anybody, saying, well, of course, I used to be in a band myself once. And then you play that little guessing game. And I love that game.
Yeah. Do they go,
because they always go, no, they always say, you won't have heard of it. I always say, no, try me.
Yeah.
I probably have.
Yeah.
I had an absolutely catastrophic version of this, actually, once when one of my sons went to his new school. We went to this parents' evening. And you know when you're wearing a little badge and it says who your son is and all that. And, you know, it's like, you know, you're there sort of taking Lyle Sugar or something. And I look over, there's a bloke, I think I recognise him. He said, it's only Martin Taylor of Wishbone Ash. And, you know, and so...
Was it Martin Turner?
And I went up to him and I said, I completely blew it, actually. I said, my God, I can't believe Martin Turner of Wishbone Ash. That's fantastic. I said, when I was 15, I sat underneath your microphone stand at Bracknell Sports Centre.
He doesn't want to hear
tried,
that.
No, Dave, that's just where you're wrong.
Oh, right.
And I wanted to work out how you played the bass part to Phoenix, right, which is off there, the Wishbone Ash.
Did he show
Phoenix, rise, raise your head, boom, from the sky. It's absolutely shocking song. And it's in three time, which is even more pretentious. And, of course, it could go either way. It's either kind of like, sorry, I just don't, you know, I'm just shaking hands today, you know, not signing up, you know what I mean? Just the reverse. The guy followed me around for weeks. I couldn't get rid of him.
I was clearly
the first person. What happened to me when I met Mike Ratledge of the Soft Machine, who I lived next door to when I lived in Hackney about 30 years ago. I used to see Mike Ratledge walking down the street.
The square glasses.
Sorry, Andrew. We're going to get straight back to New Order in a second. And old Ratledge and his rectangular. And I went up to him once. I said, I'm sorry, this probably happens all the time. He said, no. No, it doesn't. I said, I think you're right, Mike Ratledge. I'm a little bit excited. No, that's absolutely fine.
And he was thrilled.
Yeah, and again, I walked off. I've got to go to the tube now. And he just literally walked all the way to the tube with me, going on about the great days of the Soft Machine.
You see, generally speaking, though, people are delighted to be recognised.
Of course they are.
Well, they are. Yeah, they've got a certain point in the bell curve.
Go on.
Well, when they've been over the hump of their career and they've kind of internalised the fact that maybe they're not going to be right back on the pyramid stage next year as soon as the new material comes out, then, when they realise that they kind of are where they are and they're staying there, they start to be happy that people remember who they are and recognise them.
Right.
But when they still think that they're on the, you know, they're entitled to just hold their hand in your face and go, not now, mate.
Yeah.
Or, you know, I have
had that. Well, have you had none now, mate?
Not me, because
you don't
I
get that from members of Rare Bird, I tell you.
No, because
would you like to come?
I tend to run into these people when I'm actually.
Was there a point sometimes?
You know, when they're either waiting for me in a pub or I'm waiting for them in a pub to talk to them. You know what I mean? But there is a kind of, you know.
Have you never approached a famous person in the street, but do no kind of professional hat on at all, and just kind of created some kind of link?
I interrupted what's his name from the Daily Show, the English guy, John Oliver. The other week. I was so excited. It's John Oliver from The Daily Show. He's my hero. And I ran out of the restaurant to say, hey, I think you're great. Just as he was about to swoop in for a bout of tongue hockey with his girlfriend, who obviously hadn't seen in ages because he lives in America and she lives in London.
So it's just so romantic.
Just as they're about to lock lips and having separated for months on end, there's me going, hey, I think you work great. I love your stuff. It's fantastic. But he took it in good part, and the girlfriend sort of, you know, whiled away the few minutes while I passed him. He was quite glad to.
I think generally speaking, people are fine as long as they don't feel that they're going to be stuck there for absolutely hours, and there's going to be, you know, a queue of autographed hunters behind them. Mark Allen is trying to wedge the door shut. Yeah. Holding business cards.
Keep the pigeons out.
To keep the sound of young Islington out. Yeah.
The Word, a magazine, a website, a podcast, a way of life.
But at the same time, HMV are working with this new concept in their Dudley store, which they describe as a compelling multi-channel social shopping space and experience.
Well, that contains several alarm words like space, compelling, experience, and all the other stupid...
Multi.
Well, multicoloured swap shop is fine. In fact, this sounds like what they're launching here. As you sit there flogging the stuff that you just bought on eBay using the computers that they're lending to you.
So you're going to be able to drink a smoothie while choosing a record. Now, I've got a terrible confession to make before we go any further. I don't know what a smoothie is. Occasionally.
You don't live in West London. Well, the people who invented smoothies went to the school at the bottom of our road.
Is that the Innocent Smoothie people?
The Innocent Smoothie people, yeah.
This podcast brought to you by Innocent Smoothies. Yes, Carry on.
Look at this product placement here. And they've invented a very wonderful and nutritious fruit drink, Dave, which cost an A and an L, but it's absolutely delicious.
What it is, Dave, is, you know, like in the past, when people got too old to chew, they would mash and pulp up the fruit and squirt it down their throat as they lay there on the bed praying for death. Now, when you're young and groovy, that's when you pulp up, mash up the fruit and chuck it down your throat, because you're probably off to see the Klaxons at a rave or something, you know? It's like,
Dave, it's for people who are, like, too busy to eat or drink, I think. In fact, do you remember in Space Odyssey 2001, do you remember that?
Yeah, I remember that
one, space food in Space Odyssey basically...
Leonard Rossiter,
It's microwaved food in sort of tablet form.
You were saying earlier, can we get on the subject of music?
Now we're talking about the food.
I attempted to get, Lasso, the octopus, back into the brown paper bag. An attempt to get on the subject of music. We're talking about HMV. And within about 40 seconds, Leonard Rossiter made an appearance in the conversation.
I don't want to talk about HMV, you see. I don't think it's very interesting, so I'm desperately trying to change
now, it. It is very interesting. Because we have said that if record shops are going to survive, they're going to make themselves destinations. They've got to make themselves places
they used to be destinations.
When
we were all kids, even when I was a kid, recently... they were destinations. used to make a trip to town to go to the record shop.
And hang about for hours.
If they'd let you in, you could get up the bottle to get in there.
I'm really worried about where I grew up. War-torn Liverpool.
No, going to Probe in Liverpool was... you really had to screw up your courage, because everybody in there was cool, mean... and taller than you. Everybody's taller than me anyway. And the counter was huge. And behind the counter, scowling at you, was Pete Burns.
I can see how that might be upsetting.
And so you needed it.
That would have been terrifying. Did he look
like
Pete
Burns?
He was quite
nice, actually. Yeah, it was Pete Burns. He was quite all right in there, but he was
in before
full
the old collagen injected lips. Yeah. And stuff,
going back a step. Now you know about this because I'm interested in this because dance record shops. Was this a dance record shop?
No, it was Pro Punk Record Shop.
So where did the thing come from? Whenever I go past dance record shops, dance specialists in Soho, and they're usually kind of painted black at the front, aren't they? And they've got about five records inside.
Yeah.
And they've got a counter.
It looks like a sex shop.
Yes. And there's clearly the person behind the counter is standing on a platform yeah. make him about a foot above
yeah.
even the tallest customer.
What do you
is
think
that a dance record thing? It, or is that a DJ
it
thing?
It became more... It got more and more accentuated as the rave took off, because it used to be... You know, we all know that record companies can be quite intimidating and people behind the counter very full of themselves, but in dance music, because there was exclusivity of records, the number of times you go to, oh, you know, what have you got? Oh, sorry, mate, that's only for the DJs. Well, how do you know I'm not a DJ?
So they'd have it. I'm interested yeah. in this. They'd have it.
How do you know that?
And you had the coin of the realm and they wouldn't let you have it.
Yeah, save it for DJs, mate. Or, actually, more often than not, because it was based on having incredibly new things that nobody else had. Instead of going in and saying, hello, I would like to buy the new single by Rhythmatic on Network Records, please. You'd go in and go, I like Yorkshire Bleep Clonk. What have you got? And they'd say, well, I've got this, this, and this. But you can't have them because they're for the DJs. However, I have got this, which you can have. And then you say, can I listen to it? And they'd go, all right, then. And they'd have to wait for 20 minutes while the fellow behind the counter's mate was practicing on the deck.
The deck.
Because he probably didn't have a Technics at home.
Right.
And then if you're lucky, you got to play 30 seconds of, you know, this kind of new Bleep Clonk that you wanted, and then you might decide you'd happily part with the £6.
So you didn't say, I'm sick of being treated in this fashion, I'm going down to Woolworths.
They would say,
Woolworths
is that away, man, they'd say. No, yeah, because you had to go through the, you know, the humiliation and all that. But then on the other hand, if you got in with the record shop, it was great, because I used to go to a record shop in Leeds called Crash, where the guy behind the counter, the wonderful Chuck, later of the band The Hollow Men, and still knocking about, he's a very good bloke, basically relieved me of all my student grant money for fantastic records. But he would
is that how you got in with the shop? By allowing them to relieve you of your entire grant? That's pretty good customer relationship.
Yeah. No, I used to go in and I used to say to Chuck, what's here? And he'd go, this is what you need. And he'd go, you need this,
that's
you need
quite
this,
like this. It's almost like a prescription.
Yeah.
That's quite good.
Yeah. I remember going into Jumbo Records in Leeds and being told that I needed the De La Soul album. Nobody heard of De La Soul at all. You need this one. Take it away. You need it.
That's good. That's good.
And
style.
It worked out.
That's
so,
a good technique.
So it wasn't all.
So this is interesting. This sort of ties in with what I was wondering about, this whole megastore thing, and I was trying to write this column for the next issue of Word about it. That it strikes me that at some point in the 90s, I can remember when megastores, big stores, were hugely exciting. You went in somewhere that had everything.
Oh, yeah.
And then I think we kind of pass at some point during the 90s, it'd be great to put a date on it, we suddenly had too much stuff. And so you go into a shop and you think, I'm depressed by how much
I remember that honeymoon period vividly, because I remember Paul DeNoyer writing a wonderful piece, he writes a lot for Word, writing a wonderful piece about the HMV Megastore at Oxford Circus, and saying it was a day's ride on a fresh horse to get from the reggae section to the shop.
Yeah, yeah.
And that seemed really exciting.
Yeah.
You're right, you reacted against it, you wanted to go back to specialist stuff.
Whereas, you know,
what
you
Andrew's
take your
talking
dance,
about is so attractive. But you're going there, you're dealing with a major expert who is prescribing precisely
but
what you
need. But then the real megastores had to sort of turn themselves into these kind of bustling souks where you'd think it was a megastore, but actually this bit here is the dance section, and it's full of white labels, and it's full of things, you know, that have been written on in magic marker, Hot Tune, Major Trance, whatever, you know, Jewels, East came
in.
It
was very similar around the Dan Hicks records.
Yeah. Yeah, so, you know, so the megastores had to start to emulate the specialist dance stores.
And did they do it convincingly?
They did it pretty well, actually. I mean, well, the ones in London, I think. I mean, Oxford Street HMV, the Imperial Death Star of selling records, did pretty well, largely because they could walk around the corner to a specialist store, see what they were selling, and probably emulate it, I would have thought. And it was a pretty great great service on the dance side. But I think that moment you're talking about, you know, when we all realised that actually we don't need everything in one place, if you look, you'll see it coincides with the invention of the internet, because that's the point at which you go, actually, do I really want to trudge into town to try and find this thing, or will I just buy it off Amazon?
Yeah, because you're, with a thing like Amazon and other retailers, you're straight into the stock control mechanism, aren't you?
Yeah.
You're not having to decide which bit of the store to go to ask for it, hope that the assistant knows that they've got it and all that. You just type it in and there it is, you know how many copies they've got, pretty much.
Don't you think this kind of this character that Andrew's describing so clearly, that I think anyone who's seen the film of High Fidelity, you know, the Jack Black character who works in the record shop, everybody has met that guy. I don't know if you remember him, but there's a guy who comes in every day and he wants to buy a Captain Beefheart bootleg. And eventually he says, come in on Friday and I'll sell it to you. And he comes in and he just says, I've changed my mind. I don't feel like selling it today. And it's just wonderful, the kind of power and arrogance of these people.
Yeah. But those places are disappearing.
Yeah, and actually that's part of the reason why they're disappearing. Because
entirely.
If you went into the HMV and said, I want you know, this weird mix of whatever. They didn't say we're saving that for the DJs. They said, £6, sir.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
I wish you'd like a discount card for your next purchase.
Now, tell me if this is significant, because I've been on holiday the last few years to Brittany, and we tend to go into Camper, which is the sort of nearest largish town, very nice old, you know, cathedral town. And there is one record shop in Camper, as far as I can work out, and it's down a very pleasant cobbled street, and it's
harmonious. The disc spinning. No. It's do all those jokes again in French.
Fidelité out. Yeah. Sans le voix de son maître. Anyway,
yeah, go on, yeah.
And it's a bit of a specialist in classical music, world music, jazz. It's very kind of authentic, and it's a tiny shop. Because there's quite a few people around on a decent day, there's quite a few people in there. And the last few years, I have been in there and just killing time for about half an hour or something while some members of my family are shopping elsewhere. And there is usually a girl serving in there. And this being France, it's very often a pretty girl serving in there who is immensely helpful and keeps coming around and saying, is there anything... anything you want me to find for you or whatever. And I just wander around. And I, every year, I spend £30 just because this place is so nice.
Yeah.
It's full of stuff that I kind of like the idea of. And when I get it home, I
never
really
play it again. Yeah.
But I sort of like the idea of it. It's the perfect, you know, coincidence between the product and the place and the politeness of the person. Yeah. And you do sort of wonder whether this is something that might come back in the world of record shops. Because I also...
This very attractive female assistant.
It's not some guy in a black t-shirt looking down his nosy.
The audio equivalent of those kind of cheap bottles of Spanish brandy that taste really nice on holiday.
The record, you know, they suck. Yeah. It sounded so brilliant on the campsite.
Well, that's France.
It was played to me by a rather attractive French female.
But anyway, on the 27th of July... I remember this because it's my birthday. My wife and I were in the West End wandering around, and we went big record shops on Oxford Street, and there was tumbleweed blowing through these places.
Really?
We walked up Marylebone High Street, and I'll give them free publicity. Daunts in Marylebone High Street is, you know, they call themselves the most beautiful bookshop in London, and they
quite
are
quite rightly.
And they're a beautiful place. Very, very well run, and they tend to be a specialist travel bookshop, but they do lots more than that. And I go in there Friday afternoon, and it's packed. And these are people buying books. They're buying books to take on holiday, paying full price for books quite happily. But what they've done is this place has defined its customer absolutely brilliantly.
Completely,
and it's not just that you can't download books, is it? It's something more than that.
It's something more than that. You walk in there, and it's, you know, you have a relationship with this, and this is going to sound terribly snobby. You'd like to feel you have a relationship with the other customers.
Oh yeah,
Dawn's, it's a little bit like restaurants sell them.
It's precisely Dawn's Bookshop. The people who go there feel they are. It's probably like being equivalent of a kind of club class or something.
Yeah,
because they feel they are. It's a bit like when you're on an aeroplane and you see somebody across the aisle, a total stranger, and they pick up a copy of New Yorker, and you've got a copy of New Yorker too.
Aren't we clever?
We're brilliant.
Bloody great.
We're going to sit here and feel really smug now for 8 hours.
Back at the
we're going to come to New Yorker. Yeah.
Me and Lily are reading Viz. Right.
But it's a bit of that, isn't it?
Yeah, no, you just wonder. And I thought to myself, there is no record shop like this. Not that I know. You know, there are kind of, there are sort of, you know, championship vinyl type, you know, caves and cellars, you know, with guys in mad t-shirts and, you know, with Captain Beefheart bootlegs. But I don't know anywhere, I don't know an upmarket record shop.
Well, maybe they should start offering free glasses of fine and complex Bourgogne Aligotti, David, you're walking through the door and a beetroot risotto pancake.
Served by Amelie from the film. Yes.
No, you see,
bonjour, Monsieur Epworth.
Yes, I will buy any number of records.
Grand Pile de Gis,
Grand Pile de Gis, Epworth. Is it not time you went to La Plage avec votre family?
Yeah. Oh, man,
I do not want to go out to dinner tonight, Mr. Evans. No.
Record shop
three times
about,
in 1 week.
Shut up! Enough with the French. That shop you're talking about, though, you know, could you do the record shop that's a nice place to be? Everybody, and people laugh at this, the Starbucks record enterprise, Hear Music, their label. But there are a handful of here record shops in America.
Oh, this is their own label, right.
And I went to one in San Francisco, Here Music. And, of course, you know, you see Starbucks, you think, that's it, the death of rock. The most corporate thing going. I went there, it was great. Really? Really nice. Lots of comfy chairs, listening posts, friendly people, a really good selection of music.
So what were they stocking, though?
They had everything. They had weird, wonky electronica. They had Starbucks music. Obviously, they had jazz and Joni Mitchell and Paul McCartney and all that carry on. But they also had, you know, if you wanted Ortega and plunky music like that, they had reggae. They
but presumably, they didn't have, I'm guessing, presumably they didn't have everything. Because when I go into the shop in Quimper, and when I go into Daunt's, the bookshop, I tend to assume that the stock is a little bit of a selection in itself.
Well, yeah, no,
I tend
right.
to think it's there, sort of because it's good.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's it. You're right. It's not everything. You don't walk in and you're not confronted by Racks of the Hardfire album and Robbie Williams' Greatest Hits and Would You Like to Buy Back in Black by Amy Winehouse. You go in and it's you feel like you're entering a place where they've taken a little bit of time over what they're going to offer you, and they're going to let you sit down and listen to it for a bit and have a cup of coffee if you want.
I think it's going to be interesting to see what happens in this huge, great shakeout. You know, FOP being taken over by HMV, HMV repositioning itself, loads of this, you know, retail space becoming available. Yeah. I think it's going to be interesting to see if anybody does anything like that. I mean, it clearly can't succeed in every high street in the country. It's just not going to. But you wonder if it could happen in certain pockets. You know.
Well, it could be this. I mean, I remember when I was a teenager, coming to London and going to the Virgin Megastore was a big deal. And it was what you would attempt to bunk off the visit to the House of Commons to do, to go to, you know, get your copy of whatever you couldn't get in whatever provincial town you lived in. And I can see the kind of Borders-ification happening, you know, because people do go and just hang around in Borders for a while and read some books and coffee and then realise they've spent 3 hours just doing nothing, really. And that's fine. But you wonder whether that could be applied to music, partly because of the nature of music. You've got to, you know, plug yourself into something to hear it. And also because music's appeal is actually quite young. You know, it's one thing hanging around in Borders while everybody's sitting about reading a lovely book of travel, you know, or some poetry. It's another thing going to a record shop where there's hundreds of kids there who want to hear the latest grind tune.
Yes.
They want to hear the Libertines.
Well,
you know,
there may be a future in a record shop that doesn't let people under the age of 40 go in, you know.
Well, let's get the VCs together, Dave, and I'm sure we can see what we can do.
I still like the idea that David, you're going to this French shop and saying how friendly they are, because it works the other way, because they don't get many customers calling them mon petit chouchou when they go in the morning. Oh, we've done this joke, haven't we? Yeah. Sorry, we've done it. Yeah, move on.
It's done au monde.
A magazine, a website, a podcast, The Word.
I saw a clip the other day of Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young picking up some award for still being alive. You know.
Look away from the screen now, viewers. This could be stressful. I know what you're going to say.
And
those guys have got a right load of stewart, haven't they?
There are four members, okay? Three members look as if you are seeing them through the back of a spoon.
Yeah, it's true,
Who are they, Mark?
Well, they're the ones. It looks like the funny mirror down the bottom of the pier, doesn't it? They
are they?
Crosby and Stills. But the weird thing is that Nash. But I think this is maybe some weight transference has taken place, because Nash appears to be a sort of seven-stone beanpole who's donated quite generously 2 or 3 stone each to these guys. And I think they should have a sort of, they should just sort of pool it all again.
You say there's intra-band liposuction on the
ground. It's something very like that. But I mean, the Cross, do you remember when they appeared at Live Aid? I can remember the shock. We hadn't seen them for years. And the Cross came on, and the man was gigantic, wasn't he? The old walrus there. He thought, well, but then again, you thought he had a tendency to go that way. Then the camera pans left, hey, we saw Stephen Stills. Do you remember? I was watching it with you, actually. And he was just ginormous, wasn't he? There was about three of him.
They sent up a satellite to photograph the other side of it.
That's right. They had to put an RSJ under that section of the stage. The man was huge.
Anyway, as Bob Monkhouse once said, a man built in the days when meat was cheap.
Well, Peter, we don't see the man who got his money's worth out of an I Speak Your Weight machine. We've done that on before. But anyway, does this lead naturally onto
this question, it struck me as an interesting area. Is who are the best and worst preserved elder statesmen of popular music?
Well, never look at a picture of a member of Yes. I don't think.
I wouldn't know if I was looking at a member of Yes.
I mean, it's terribly disrespectful to say this about the great Steve Howe, but he man looks like a melted candle. Do you know what I mean? His face used to have just dropped. He does. And the summer looked really well preserved.
Yeah, go on.
Still. Well, I think Robbie Robertson still looks pretty good. I think Keith Richards, I mean, obviously it's ridiculous to apply Keith Richards.
What are you preserving?
Yes.
A well-preserved Keith
Richards.
He looks like
he's literally been pickled in vinegar. It's like a walnut.
When we note the fact that the Rolling Stones, for a bunch of gentlemen in their 60s, all have their hair, are we a bit suspicious?
I'll have their hair. I'll have hair.
Yeah. Somebody's hair, anyway.
A head of hair.
Are we in any way suspicious? Yeah.
What, that being incredibly rich actually makes you get rattled in a different way to the way the rest of us get rattled?
No, the richer you are, the more
your hair
done,
becomes so luxuriant and thick, thatch-like.
There's been some thatching work gone on.
Some thatching.
Some thatching. That's easy for you to say. It's like the Michael Palin character in this.
Yes. Oh, Brian. Anyway, I did my top five best preserved. Okay, go on. In reverse order. Number five, Phil Collins.
Well, he looked like that.
He looks exactly the same.
He's always looked like a potato, and it hasn't changed.
You know, so 35 years down the line or whatever, not changed at all.
Yeah.
Susie, 50.
Looks better. All right. Looks better, actually. Looks better. I think she looks better, yeah. Looks terrific.
Admittedly, there's a fair amount of slap. She'd be the first to kill it.
But then there always was.
It's a good look to grow into,
you know.
Yeah.
And she'll grow into it even better when she's 18.
And number three.
Yeah.
Well, bold as a coot, but I think wears it very well. James Taylor.
Yeah, it looks terrific. It looks very, very young.
He looks as if he's kind of arrived at the age that he ought to be, actually.
Yeah.
Doesn't look as if he's clinging on to former glories. My own personal, you know I've always carried a torch.
Go on.
For...
Cool.
And I note she's 60 at her next birthday.
Oh, I've got to guess. It's not going to be Patti Smith, is it? Did I trip you up there? She's gorgeous.
Yeah. Dave's computer is covered in pictures of it. Yeah.
No, go on. I've thrown you down, haven't I? I've thrown you. Yeah. Patti Smith, those big old tattoos. Oh, shut up and shave. No. Sorry, where were we?
Come on, then.
I was talking about Lulu.
Oh, Lulu!
Really?
Oh, that's absolutely fair comment.
Lulu, sensational.
Great haircuts, too.
She looks fantastic. Yeah. And at number one, I only say this because I saw a picture of him yesterday arriving at the Emmy Awards or whatever in the States. Tony Bennett.
Oh, yeah.
He's 81 years old. And he looks sensational.
Yeah.
And not in a kind of desperate, I've been worked on in a huge way sensational. He looks like an older character in The Sopranos.
And you think the man's...
Yeah, I was just thinking exactly that. I was thinking Phil Leotardo from The Sopranos is and Tony Bennett. They're the same guy.
And he's...
He's eaten
100 weight. He's eaten his own body weight in tortellini every day, isn't he? And sucked down a big vat of very fine red wine.
So, Tony Bennett, God bless you, sir. You know, he's topping my best preserve.
I've got to add John Fogerty. Have you seen a picture of John Fogerty recently, or are they heavily retouched?
No, I've seen... Yeah, I don't know.
Oh, God, just put him back in a check shirt. It'd be the same bloke he was when he was 25.
Really?
Well, then again, he probably made quite a lot of money. He could quite easily have spent the last 25 years just sitting in a hammock, strung between two gigantic redwood trees.
That probably makes you
reading
fat,
a copy of Vanity Fair. Maybe it would be, I don't know. Yeah, I don't think he's had a lot of stress in his life. Right. No?
How about you?
Royalties pouring.
Well, it's funny because of my heroes, few of them have gone over the other side of 50 yet, so we're not going to find out. For a few years.
Some of them look as if they're... New Order look as if they're racing past 50.
New Order, I think they're the wrong side of 50 now, and they certainly have got... They're subject to gravity now. They're a bit wider than they were.
But they don't look
catastrophically bad. You know, Morrissey and Johnny White, I think, look pretty good.
Morrissey looks very good. Is there work there?
I don't think there is, actually. I think
There's a bit of hair colour going on there.
There's a bit of hair colour, but what there isn't is any stitchery going on. You can see.
Have you gone around the back of him and had a look behind the ears?
I've been around the back of Morrissey, Dave, and I can attest that the hair has not been interfered with, except possibly with a bit of coloureage.
Do you remember Keith Richards when he kept dyeing his hair? Because Mick Jagger clearly dyes his hair. Because, Ronald Reagan, his face starts to look whiter and whiter. In fact, Reagan said, I don't dye my hair, I bleach my face. He didn't say that, actually. Sorry, we used to say it about it. But Keith decided one day to stop dyeing his hair, didn't he? What he did was, he let it grow out for about 2 or 3 months, but he didn't really see it, and then he dyed it blue.
Yeah.
Do you remember that?
Didn't he fill it with keys to distract you from the fact that he didn't initially go, Christ, stop dyeing his hair.
Yeah, he filled it full of trinkets and sort of spoons.
Dare we raise the question of Bono's hair, which is a suspicious matter. let's be honest.
No, okay, well, right, let's just go back a step. Now, well, Bono, does when he appears, does he generally have something on his head?
Yeah, I don't know.
It's like very black. Headgear or something.
It's not his hair, it's the eyes. Is it just the... You never see his eyes. He's always got these glasses on.
That's yeah. That's true.
Oh right.
Now the hair is the hair is getting more aggressively super black.
Mm. Oh it's right. Well, there's bound to be colourage.
Yeah,
bound to be.
But do you think there's a bit of forward creepage on the go as well? Assisted forward creep.
But gentlemen our age, not Andrew's age, but Dave my age, you're going to get a haircut, and they now offer you a cut and colour. Have you ever been tempted by that? They have a cut and colour, Mark. It's a little trim. I know exactly. Look at a little trim. And then they just, you know, hold you upside down by your ankles and dunk you in a great vat of tar.
They offered you a cut and colour.
I have been offered. There was a guy who used to work at, well, he works for, I can't mention who he is, obviously, Barry McElhenney. But he works for, let's call him Mr. X, though. His real name is Barry McElhenney. He works for Barry, very briefly, I hope you're not listening to this, Baz, did go for the cut and colour.
Somebody
took him for a walk around the block and put a paternal arm around his shoulder. Probably me, and said, "Baz, leave it. You're just going to finish up like Keith was. In 10 years' time, you'll have little spoons in your hair. You're doing all that shit.
You'll have a penis earring.
Yeah.
And then where will you be? Your own children might recognise you.
I know, that's it.
So, anyway, Best and Worst Preserved. We'll probably sling that up on the... Sorry, I deafened Matt.
We had a special request from a viewer. No more clapping or slapping the knee. It's making my eardrums go a foot into my head.
Lots of vehicles were speeding down motorways in excess of speed of it. Now, these people probably just ploughed off into a grass bird.
Yep.
The sheer racket of Dave applauding. The stereo.
So Best and Worst Preserved, that'll be on the site and you can contribute to that, your own suggestions.
Yeah.
The Word, a magazine, a website, a podcast, a way of life.
But at this point in the program, it is customary for Andrew and me to go. It's time for the horror.
The horror, yes.
The
horror old rock anecdote.
And this week, I'm pleased to announce that it's not me. Over to Mark Henry Allen.
All right. Actually, I must just mention first this terrific email I got here from Gary, who says how much he'd enjoyed listening to our hoary old rock anecdotes. He says he passes them off as his own to impress people at dinner parties.
So do we.
Very funny. He says, Mark, could you make sure that this week's horror is a winner? Because I'm having a Latin American themed dinner party next week. Perhaps you can deliver a Latin American themed HORA.
Okay. So rather than have it again, I think we should have.
Because the Mexicans dance on the hats.
Yeah. Oh, I see. Yeah. I thought you were doing I Moosey by Modern Romance. That's way off, wasn't
it?
No, no. I don't know. I tell you what. I thought I might briefly do it. I have to do it really quickly because it's such a long, complicated story. It doesn't have a massive, hilarious punchline, but it does tell you so much about the world of rock and roll. I think, which is the story of the Stones at Live Aid. Have I told you? I'm sure I have. Well, the Stones at Live Aid, if you remember, they didn't play.
There were no Stones.
And we'll come to that later. But there was no Rolling Stones at Live Aid. And about 3 or 4 weeks after Live Aid, I got to interview Ronnie Wood and his wife Jo for those sort of couples features they used to do in Elle magazine. And we stumbled through this, chat about the kids and the garden and what colour furniture they had. At the end of it, I said, "Look, Ronnie, I've just got to ask you something." Because Live Aid was very fresh in our minds. I said, what on earth happened to the Rolling Stones? And also I wanted to ask him what on earth had happened to Bob Dylan. Because remember, it was absolutely, let's be honest, catastrophic performance.
Shambolic.
And Ronnie told me the story. It was brilliant. Well, basically what happened was Bob Geldof had rung up Mick Jagger early on and said, we're having this charity show. Would you like to sign up? And of course, Mick Jagger had said no. No, he wouldn't, because I understand this to some extent. You know, the guy he only knew as the former member of the Boomtown Rats. His career was at an all-time low. Bit of a chance, a bit of a wide boy, trying to get him to, attach himself contractually to something that might just finish up with him and Bananarama or whatever. It was a stone, and nobody else. Nick Kershaw, obviously, and Sade, and would not be the great earth-moving thing. So Mick Jagger turned it down. And very, very rapidly it became obvious that Live Aid was going to be the most colossal story. And that The Who had reformed to play it, and Led Zeppelin had reformed to play it. And the Stones began to regret bitterly that Mick Jagger had taken this decision on their part not to play. And then Mick Jagger himself had managed to get himself crowbar, manacled himself onto the bill. Not in England, but in America. I think he was second on the bill in America, supporting Bob Dylan. And then brought on to back up his show, I think Hall & Oates, if I remember rightly, and
Tina
Turner.
Well, he did the video with David Bowie.
Oh, no, that comes later, right? That comes later.
Did he actually play in the States?
No, that's come. Yes, he played. He played. That comes later. At this point,
Keith
Richards and Ronnie Wood are out. I don't think Charlie Watts particularly cared one way or the other, but Keith Richards and Ronnie Wood, you know, if there's a big old party going on, and they're going to be, they want to be on it. And the idea that Mick Jagger has turned down the Stones and has now got himself on the bill. So they're sitting there. There's only 2 weeks to go, right? And they're in Ronnie's brownstone house in New York. I remember him describing this, him and Keith. And they got a call from Bob Dylan. And Bob Dylan had been asked to headline the Philadelphia show. And actually, Dylan's career was at a real low point then. I mean, in 1985, it was not his happiest time. And he had kind of lost his nerve and didn't feel he could actually finish this show without a little bit of support. So this was perfect. Two guys who wanted to play Live Aid, with one guy who hadn't really got the nerve to be the headlining act. So they all got together and said, right, we'll play with you. At which point Jagger managed to cobble together in only about 10 days and a further piece of ammunition, which was his appearance with David Bowie in a video of Dancing on the Street. Do you remember that? Just to make sure there was even more Mick Jagger in the show. And I just watched it actually on YouTube. It is absolutely astonishing. Do you remember Mick Jagger wears a kind of a lime green blouson? Do you remember? Yeah. It's like a lime green shirt with very sort of, baggy sleeves. And Bowie comes on wearing a sort of ghastly primrose type of Macintosh, and so this was the final straw. You know, they just couldn't stand it. So he'd been on, and Ronnie told me that, and I wanted to know with Ronnie why the performance had been so absolutely catastrophic. Do you remember how bad? You probably remember watching.
I didn't watch it. I avoided it.
Just appalling. And I finished up watching it in the Live Aid club with Bob Gallop. I remember Bob Gallop being absolutely astonished.
They were all shouting abuse.
They were shouting abuse. Actually, they couldn't believe how mad it was.
Excellent.
And excellent.
So did I. Yeah.
Yeah. And anyways, I said, Ronnie, you've got to explain to me what went wrong. And he says, well, half the problem was they got there quite early and the show had gone on a bit late or whatever. And there'd been too much refreshment, he said, which I took to mean probably large balloon glasses of brandy and probably, unless we hear from my learned friends otherwise, probably large quantities of nose ningle. That's what I'm reckoning. I reckon there's a bit of ningle going on. But anyway, by the time they stumbled up those stairs on the stage, right, you've got to remember various things, right? A, they were obviously completely out of it. They looked shocking. Ronnie was wearing a vest, I think, which is, everyone doesn't want to draw too much attention to. He'd been given the wrong guitar for some reason. The guitar was completely out of tune. And when they get up there, he says he can hear, behind the star curtain, the whole of We Are the World, which was the Lionel Richie all
rehearsing.
We're rehearsing their song, We Are the World. And only 3 feet behind him was Cyndi Lauper. So Cyndi Lauper is practicing her 75 notes per second delivery, which is going to steal the show 3 minutes later. And they're all struggling. So they start playing. He said they'd rehearsed, they decided with Dylan what songs they were going to do, made a list of the three songs they could not, go off this track. So it was awesome. And Dylan starts playing a song called The Ballad of Hollis Brown, which is from The Times They Are Changing in 1964. Not a well-known song, even for a great Dylan student like Ronnie. So Ronnie, at this point, said to me, I've never heard this song. I said, I'd heard of Collis Brown, so I thought, presumed it was a song about a cough mixture. But anyway, so you've got to imagine, he's playing a guitar that's completely out of tune on a song he's never heard and thinks is about cough mixture, with Cyndi Lauper singing 6 feet
in
behind
front
him.
Of in front of
the largest
TV
television
audience
that has ever been assembled and ever will be assembled, wearing a string vest. And I mean,
But at least... they were above Mick on the bill.
They were above
Mission
Mick.
So
who won? They won.
They won.
I thought it was fantastic. It tells you so much about the kind of tortured complexity of these events.
Because when there's a major star-studded concert, the only place a star doesn't want to be is sitting at home watching it on the telly.
I know.
They can't bear it.
No.
It absolutely eats away at them.
I know. You can't blame them.
They're hoping it's going to be a complete catastrophe, so they'll say, I showed a great deal of foresight in being at that, didn't I? Anyway, thank you very much for the horror. Hooray! Jolly good. And that's it from the Word Podcast for this week. Anything you want to know about the magazine, wordmagazine.co.uk. Thanks for listening.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word. Details at wordmagazine.co.uk.